right, welcome back to the I'm There podcast, guys. I'm your host, Freeway. I'm here with my co-host, Kenny. And today, we are here to talk about the movie Dune, which is a really, really good movie. It has a lot of tropes that reminded me of Star Wars, and come to find out, this movie actually, or I should say, this series, the original novel, inspired Star Wars. So this predates Star Wars, actually. It came out 44 years before Star Wars was ever written, in the 70s. This movie came out in, like, the 40s, or I should say...
The book
came out in the 40s, and it has that whole The Chosen One thing going on, the prince that was promised, the savior of them all, the one. It does a lot of that, but I think it's actually really good, this remake. And so we just wanted to talk about it because it was one of the bigger movies that came out in 2021. Also, it did really well in a box office, but it also did well at the Oscars. Like, it won... It was nominated for 10 Oscars, and it actually won 6 out of 10 of them, which is pretty insane. And I'll actually pull up a list of Dune's Oscar wins, because I was actually impressed by the fact that I didn't expect it to win 6 out of 10. Like, when I saw it nominated for things like Best Picture, I knew it wasn't going to win something like that. But even still, like, to win 6 out of 10 Oscars is nothing to scoff at, so...
You know what's kind of funny is we briefly talked about this earlier... but we were saying how things that win Best Picture are always, like, really pretentious movies.
Yeah, they tend to be.
And, like, granted, there's some really good movies that won Best Picture, but there's a lot of times, like, these really pretentious movies that win it. But anyway, my point is, Dune, I guess as a novel, you know, however many years ago it was, in the 70s, I wouldn't say it's pretentious, but it was definitely different. Like, it's, as much as Lord of the Rings is usually credited as... sort of the godfather and the creator of fantasy, like, Dune is probably the most influential science fiction novel in terms of, like, the science fiction legacy.
I think that Dune, I didn't know, like, again, I didn't even know what Dune was. I didn't know that it was such a big deal as far as just how much it influenced the future and the whole science fiction fantasy world that we have come to love. Like, I like Star Wars. Like, I genuinely do like Star Wars. I think the storyline, at least for the main series, can be a little convoluted and stuff like that, because I don't read any of, like, the side comics and all of the gap fillers. But for the most part, like, you can kind of get the storyline from just watching the 9 movies and the other side movies they did, like Rogue One, which is probably one of the better ones, and Hans and stuff like that. But yeah, you see it all over this movie. Like, you can see a lot of things that I felt like, I was like, oh shit, is this like a rip of Star Wars? And like I said earlier, it's actually other way around. So it's just kind of cool how this sets the stage for a lot of things that come after it. It's one of those cult classic type of movies. And the original movie, I think, is terrible, but maybe it's because it's so old that a lot of the technology doesn't look good now. Like, there's CG and the character casting, it's just all over the place. It's also very, whoever directed that movie, whoever did the adaptation for the first one, that's way back, like, it's super old now. They took a lot of liberties, I think, that I'm just not a fan of. It seems almost cartoonish, the way some of the characters behave in the original. So I don't think, you didn't see the original movie, right?
No, I haven't sat down and watched the whole original movie. I did, read in quotations. A long time ago, I tried listening to the audiobook for Dune.
Yeah.
And only reason why I didn't finish it, I mean, you know, just shit happens. But I remember I found an audiobook online for it, and it was 10 hours. And I was like, all right, cool. I was like, I'll just listen to this as time goes on. So I've listened to a decent portion of the audiobook. But then I got, like, pretty much all the way through that 10 hours. Mm. But then I realized that was just, like, part one of the audiobook.
Yes.
And it was actually it's 30 hours. And I just kind of never got around to listening to part two and three. So what's kind of interesting is that it's been a really long time since I listened to that. So I don't, but watching this movie, my point is, there was parts where I was like, oh yeah. Like, there's a lot of it I didn't remember. But there was, like, little parts where I was like, oh yeah, I do kind of remember that.
I'm a big fan of this movie, as opposed to the original. So I guess to give some overview...
when did you watch the original?
I watched the original the day I watched Dune on HBO Max. So Dune came out in theaters, and then it also came out on HBO Max. I wasn't able to see it in theaters. I forget what was going on around that time. But for whatever reason, I wasn't able to make it to the movies to see it. I usually see everything because I have the AMC A-list thing. But I wasn't able to see it in theaters, so I decided one day at like 2 a.m. I was up. I couldn't sleep. It was the weekend, and I just decided to put it on. I said, fuck it. My friend that I always go to the movies with told me that the movie was amazing and that I should really watch it. I looked on Rotten Tomatoes and saw it got like an 86%. And I was like, okay, you know what? It won't be a waste of my time, most likely. I most likely will like it. He told me that it was something I would definitely like. I started it, and when I tell you that I was hooked the second I started playing it at 2 a.m., I watched a full thing. And then after that, so I think I watched it like Sunday morning at 2 a.m., right? And so I had the whole Sunday. And he was talking about how like, oh, in the original movie, this and that, and then the books, this and that. And so it kind of made me start to want to know more. And I said, you know, let me watch the original just to see. And he was like, you know, it's a little out there. It's a little bit more theatrical in a sense, the original one. So I just put it on and I watched it and I was like, all right, if I had seen this first, I probably would not be really interested in watching the remake, if I'm being honest. But luckily I saw it the other way around. The remake just kills the original for me. From what I understand, the original is not regarded as a good movie. A lot of people who like the Dune lore and story do not like that original movie at all. So
yeah, once again, I haven't seen the movie that came out, but I know that it's not well regarded in terms of like being a great movie.
Yeah.
I think some people like it just as like fun, but
yeah, I mean, you'll always get that, but yeah, it's not, it's not the best. Oh, real quick though. So Dune 2021, I did say that it won like 6 Oscars. So I'll just say what they are. So it won for cinematography, for editing, score, visual effects, production design, and sound. So those are like some pretty good ones. And that all goes to say, most of those were like atmospheric things when you think about it, like the sound, the, you know, the production design, the score, the editing, like cinematography, visual effects. A lot of those things just go into building this world because this is its own universe. It doesn't take place in our universe at all. It has this entire completely separate from our world type of thing going on. So I really like that. Just like Star Wars, you know, if there's an Earth, it's long gone. It's not even mentioned. They live on their own specific planets. And I guess we should start off with just a little backstory of like what is happening, because it is kind of confusing at first. When I first watched it, I don't know why I was so interested in it, but I was able to follow the movie immediately pretty well, even though I'm always intimidated by learning all the new characters' names, learning like families' names, and then learning, you know, just all these different things. That's what Game of Thrones is kind of hard for people who've never watched Game of Thrones. When they first start watching it, there's so many characters, right? And you have to learn all of them. And then the more you watch Game of Thrones, the more it can become second nature to you. So yeah. I've only actually seen Dune twice, today being the second time I've ever watched it. I've only watched the movie one time in 2021 on HBO Max. I loved it so much. I watched the original and then I kind of, that was it. Like I never watched it again, but now I finally have a reason to. And so, yeah, the main character's name is Paul. He's played by Timothée Chalamet, who is like one of the new poster boys in Hollywood. He's definitely one of the actors that's been getting a lot of good roles. I feel like they're setting him up to be like another Tom Holland, another one of those Leonardo DiCaprio when he was younger type of guys. He has that vibe to him. He's in a lot of movies now. You see him all over the place. He's in a lot of magazines, a lot of magazine covers. He's also very pretty. So he's the main character. He plays Paul, and he is from House Atreides. So House Atreides, you can just think of them as the good guys. House Atreides are the good guys. His dad is like this super honorable man named Leto. And then you have the evil guys, the Harkonnens. And they're like some fucking subhuman. They look like humans, but they've all been, I don't want to say modified, but they are definitely, something's up with them. They're just like fucking creatures almost. Like they're humans, but they barely act like humans. They're just disgusting and their skin is super pale, almost like it's been drained of all of its blood, which I think they do actually show a scene with them hanging upside down and blood being drained out of their bodies. But they look gross. They look evil. They come from a planet where it's always raining. And then you have the Emperor. And the Emperor, they don't even show the Emperor in this actual movie, which is interesting.
The Emperor's not in the movie. Also, interestingly, it's not like directly, I mean, I guess it is directly said, but I feel like it's something that is kind of missable. And I feel that way about a lot of things in this movie, is that there is some really interesting tidbits that I think are kind of missable, but like they're related. Like House Atreides and House Harkonnen are, as far as I understand, like they are directly related. Yeah. Now, I think it's been a couple hundred years since maybe their ancestry split, but yeah. There's a part in the movie where they refer to each other as cousins.
Yeah, the Baron definitely says that to his dad before he kills him. He's like, you know, something, something cousin. And I thought that was interesting. So yeah, they are related, and there's actually, it actually goes further than that with the whole Bene Gesserit. So the Bene Gesserit is, this is where I think the movie got me. I fucking love this completely made up power, this completely made up faction of people. The Bene Gesserit, it's like a faction of women who have this power.
You want to talk about Star Wars stealing shit? They stole Jedi mind tricks.
Yes.
Straight the fuck up.
The Bene Gesserit has this thing called the voice. And when they do it in this movie, it is so fucking cool because the sound editing for it, it's like your voice gets all super amped and echoey, and you command a person to do whatever you want them to do. It is such a cool ability. It's some anime level shit. I love it. Like, honestly, I was like, yo, that's one of the powers. Like, I remember saying when I first watched Code Geass that I would love to have Lelouch's Geass powers, where he like uses the eyes and he can command you to do anything. The Bene Gesserit has the voice, and it's pretty much the same thing, but apparently it's not easy to use. You can fuck it up, and then it does nothing, or the person can resist it if they're strong enough with their own powers of the voice. So
yeah, like, he probably wouldn't be able to do it to, like, the grandma.
No. The Reverend Mother, she's, like, the truthsayer. And
the All-Mother.
The All-Mother, yeah. She is the Emperor's truthsayer, which is, like, his right-hand religious priest kind of thing. But yeah, the Bene Gesserit are broken as hell. A faction of women, they all wear these, look like funeral attire. They have veils on, black veils. They're dressed in all black always. His mom actually is of the Bene Gesserit. Apparently, she's actually created by them the same way Paul was created by them. His mother, Jess, was instructed to have only daughters for Leto, but apparently she decided to do her own thing and try to bring in the one herself by having a boy on purpose. So I know this is like a lot. If you haven't seen the movie, or even if you have seen the movie, just bear with us because there's a lot of lore here and I do want to go over it. But the Bene Gesserit apparently can manipulate like the sex of their children. They can also pass down memories and abilities to children on purpose. So when the Reverend Mother visits Paul's mom, Jess, and she's like angry with her. It's like, you were told to only have daughters and you thought that you could bring the one into the world. Basically, like, you had hubris. You were arrogant, thinking that you could be the one to fucking bring in the prince that was promised. And so you decided to have a boy and give him our powers, the voice. Like, you trained him in the way. They call it the way.
Yeah.
And cue fucking Knuckles meme right there. But he was trained in something called the way. So he has the ability to use the voice, even though he's not very good at it. In fact, one of the opening scenes is him sitting at breakfast with his mother. He just woke up and she's sitting kind of far away from him. And there's water and he wants the, like, he looks over at it as she pours some for herself. She knows exactly what he's thinking. Like, he wants water. So she says, command me to give it to you. Use the voice. And he's like, mom, I just woke up. It's like 8 a.m. And she doesn't say anything. She just looks at him like, I'm not passing you the water. Like, you have to use the voice on me. So he like closes his eyes and thinks for a long time, and then he fucking tries it, and it doesn't do anything. Like, the first time he uses the voice, it just does not work at all. She kind of just takes it in. She's like, try again, like, try harder. And when he tries the second time, that shit comes out with this really strong, echoey, loud voice, but she's able to completely, like, kind of resists it. She's like, okay, like, you know, you're better at it, but it still isn't enough.
Yeah, she ends up being forced to move the water a little bit.
Yes, and then she grabs the water and moves it. Yeah, I thought that was really cool. So there's this amazing power that just seems anime as fuck to me. I love it. I would love the ability to, I don't know, look at any human being and be like, give me your car keys. And they just have to do it. Like, they absolutely have to do it. It's like,
stuff. That's why they don't let men have it, all right? They know you're fucked up. That's why they're like, we don't train men in this shit. Y'all are fucking.
They seem to
y'all pretty, cause wars.
They were pretty serious about not giving it to men. Go ahead.
In the scene, this is pretty early in the movie, not morning. But when he gets brought to see the older woman, I forget her name.
Yeah, we just call it a Reverend Mother. I
keep calling her the All Mother in my head.
You can call her that too. That's fine. They don't know what we mean.
But he's brought to her, and then, like, you know, Jessica, Paul's mom, is like kind of nervous and scared, and Paul's brought to her, and you can tell like the All Mother's kind of annoyed, and then so when she commands him, it's like he completely. I think it's interesting because I think it's the only time in the movie they show you, I guess, what the perspective of being commanded is.
Yes.
Because she says, like, come here, kneel.
Yes.
And the screen kind of, like, goes black, and then he's in front of her, and then he kneels. And so it's like, when you get commanded, I don't even really know how much consciousness you have of what you're doing because like he just appears over there.
So let me interject here. I actually watched, after seeing the original movie, I went through a whole phase and I went on YouTube and I watched the director actually explaining how he directed a lot of the scenes. Cause the guy who directed this movie is phenomenal. I don't remember his name off the top of my head, but Jesus, he's really good at his job. And that scene was brought up in the YouTube interview that I watched. And he says he actually made it where when the Reverend Mother says, come here, kneel, and you see it go black, and then he just appears in front of her, and then you just see him kind of fall to his knees. It goes black because he wanted it to seem like you don't even remember being commanded to do what you did.
Yeah.
So what you're saying right now, Kenny, is 100% accurate. It's like when you are commanded by the voice, you don't even remember doing the thing that you were told to do. It's kind of like a dreamlike state. They actually show it go black and he kind of wakes back up. It's really quick, but it's not done for no reason. Like when you're watching it, the screen kind of goes black real quick and then it opens back up and he's just in front of her.
Yeah, it does give you a feeling. Like it is a good director choice because it does give you, even without like watching an interview or like getting,
you knew what was up.
It gives you that feeling to like say like, oh, I wonder if like this is what happened.
Yeah. And so they did that for a reason where it looks like a person blinked their eyes. It actually looks like Paul took a blink. And when he woke back up, he's in front of the Reverend Mother. Then she says, Neil, he falls down. He says, how dare you use the voice on me?
Yeah.
And
how
dare you command my mother to leave in her own house?
Oh, dude. So there was a lot of interesting stuff. So first I wanted to just finish the one point in that. So you can tell that she really, obviously, they don't want men, and they don't really tell you, like, it's not necessarily explained why they don't want men to use the power. But it's like, a female thing. They have whatever their mission is, and they give hints. This is something else that's kind of interesting, is that the movie or the book, I don't really know how it's done in the book, but so the movie, it lays these pieces for things, and you kind of just have to figure it out. I also think it's something that benefits going through more than once.
Yes.
I could tell the first time I watched the movie that I was like, oh, this is a series that you're supposed to experience more than once because it's one of those things that will like recontextualize things that you've seen.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, it's pretty clear that she has, she doesn't want men to use the power. And the thing that she's saying to him, she was like, oh, he has eyes just like his father. Like he's just as prideful or whatever. Or just as stubborn, I think she says.
Yeah.
Stubborn. And, she does the whole thing. She talks about how an animal, basically after she does the test, and the test is like, she puts his hand through like this excruciating pain. And if he removes his hand, she kills him.
Yep.
Anyway, afterwards she says like, we needed to make sure you didn't have like the instincts of a beast or whatever. To me, it really felt like I was testing to see if you were going to try to use your power or do something the way a man would. Like it seemed very much like I wanted to see if you could control your baser instincts because men would take this power and fucking start wars over it. You know what I mean?
Like animals they just act off of instinct, right? So an animal feels pain, it runs, right? It either runs or it attacks. And so those are the two things that he could have done right there. He could have pulled his hand out, which is run, or he could have attacked her and tried to use the voice on her. He tried to do something to her. So he had two options there that were both death. And I just know if he tried to do either of them, she was going to kill him so fucking quick. Which they actually show his mother outside of the room. She's standing directly outside because he looks back almost like he wants help. It's like, I'm all alone here. My mom is, but she says, your mom is standing right outside that door. No one's going to bother us. No one's going to intrude. She knows exactly what I'm about to do right now. And so he is instructed to put his hand in the box and he says, what's inside the box? And she just says, pain. That's one word, pain. Mm-hmm. And so he puts his hand in. He doesn't feel anything at first. And then she puts this thing up to his neck, this little needle. It's a poison needle that kills you instantly, apparently. And she's like, if you remove your hand from the box, I'll kill you. And we want to see if you're different from an animal. So I do like that whole setup there. Like, we want to see if you have any fucking self-control. And I was wondering if part of it may be mind over matter, because you start to see him resist it. At first, it's fucking him up bad. Like, my man is going through. He's sweating. You can see he's, like, gritting his teeth real hard. And he's staring, like, he's kind of not even looking at her. He's kind of looking down, just trying to focus, and his head is shaking. And then at some point, the music score changes, and this is why the movie just has such an amazing sound editing. But the music starts to go to this triumphant thing, right? And he lifts his head up, and he just kind of stares at her. And it's a very cocky, defiant, like, I won. This is not enough for me. Like, this is not going to be what makes me break.
It's pretty crazy, too. The visuals they show a bunch of crazy visuals. And one of the visuals is, like, a hand that fucking looks mummified.
Yes.
And which, I assume is his hand, right? Like, that's the pain he's feeling.
Yeah.
And because, like, when he takes it out, like, he looks at his hand.
He does.
Almost to be like, yo, is my hand still there? Like,
yeah, he looks at his hand. And when they do show that one vision, the hand is basically scorched. It looks like it had just been in a fire. It looks like a burn victim. It looks really bad. But yeah, that entire scene is one of my favorite scenes in the entire movie, just because it looks really cool. I love every scene that they use the voice, and they use it a lot throughout the series, which is great. Like, throughout this movie, and this is going to be a trilogy, so we have a lot more to look forward to.
Is it confirmed it's going to be three movies?
Yeah, it's going to be three movies. So there's, you know, there's that. I'm glad. I like this world building. The first movie is definitely a setup. Like, this, a lot of this movie is just set up for the overarching storyline. We definitely dropped in the middle of something, the same way I love Game of Thrones, and you're dropped in the middle of it. Like, Game of Thrones episode one, you're in the middle of the story. You're not at the beginning of something. You're at the middle. It's the same feeling when you're watching Dune. Like, House Atreides have been at war with the Harkonnens for centuries, apparently. And now they're just being commanded. The Harkonnens were commanded to leave Arrakis, which is the planet that everybody wants. And the House Atreides has been commanded to go there. Did you want to say something right there, Kenny?
No, I just said, like, Arrakis. I just said, like, it's Dune.
Yes.
Like, that's...
Yeah, so... All right, so we got the House Atreides, the good guys. You got the Harkonnens, the bad guys. You got the Bene Gesserit, which are like these sideline priests that they actually are part. They're like near every family, every major house in the universe. There's Bene Gesserit that kind of serve them. But in reality, the Bene Gesserit actually serve themselves.
They do. And dude, they put some very interesting things in there, because they make it clear that they've been around for a very long time. There's a part, it's like the scene after what we were just talking about, where Paul has his hand in, like, the thing, and he's experiencing pain. And then when she's leaving, when the All-Mother's leaving, and Paul's mother, Jessica, goes to, like, talk to her, and she's like, did you have to do all that? And she was like, I had to make sure he could control himself or whatever. But she, I'm trying to remember, she says that, like, your sisters have, like, laid a path for you. Like, she says, like, on Arrakis, like, we've done all that we can.
Yeah.
Like, the sisters have, like, laid a path for you. And then there's, like, some other things. She talks to her son afterwards, and she, like, not fully explains, but kind of explains what the Bene Gesserit do.
Yes.
And when you get fast forward a bit, you get to a part where Jessica is talking to this girl who's I think, you know, trying to be a chambermaid or whatever. She talks about, like, the prophecy and all these other things. And it's so weird and interesting. I can't remember exactly, but it seems as though the Bene Gesserit have been around for a really long time. They're said to be spread all throughout the universe and all these important houses. And they, like, lay the path, so to speak, for future Bene Gesserit people to, like, be accepted and welcomed. You know what I mean?
So I can actually fill in some of the gaps there. So basically, the Bene Gesserit, like I said, this is a religious cult, and they're all women. They're near every major house. They serve as just kind of like, they can kind of see the future, and they can also manipulate people. And people don't even realize that they have all of these crazy powers. Like, a lot of times, if you're manipulated by them, the same way Paul was commanded with the voice, you know, he only knows about it because his mom taught him. But regular people have no idea what the fuck is happening. Like, you can tell that later on in the movie when they use the voice on some of their captures, that they don't even know that they should not have them free to speak. Like, they have Paul's mom, I think, gagged, but they don't have him gagged. It's because they're like, well, women, they know that, like, women can use the voice, but they don't realize they don't even know that, like, a man can do that or that Paul can do that. They just don't have him gagged and bound the same way as his mom. And so it's like this thing where throughout history, they have been manipulating timelines and just doing all types of things to different houses, literally aiding in the rise and fall of houses. Like, whatever their will is, they believe in this thing called the golden timeline. And the way they show it is like this gigantic long worm. And at the head of the worm is like, you see kind of like the sun is on it. You know how in Christianity, they have those pictures of Jesus and like all of the saints and disciples and stuff. And they have that circle around their heads. Like whenever you.
Yeah. I noticed that on Arrakis in the, I'm going to just say the palace. There was a
drawing of
like hieroglyph. Yeah. It was a giant worm with a sun.
And that's
I didn't realize
that's representative. Yeah.
Representative of the Bene Gesserit. I assumed that was more so representative of the like Arrakis's like beliefs, and because like Arrakis and the religion of Arrakis is so seeped in the worm.
Yeah, but in actuality, it represents the golden timeline, and also like a lot of people believe in this great savior, and it's akin to like the great worm. So there's a lot of intermixing of all these different storylines coming together here. Like, the people of Arrakis, they're known as the Fremen, and they're basically just the desert people. They live underground because the planet is so fucking hot. In the daytime, you basically can't survive without something called a still suit. And a still suit is basically something that you wear that recycles all of your liquids and turns them back into drinking water so that you actually don't lose liquids. It takes a very long time for you to run out of liquids in a desert wearing a still suit. If done properly, they say. So like when you sweat, if you cry, all of those liquids get recycled by the suit's technology, and it has a little spout in the front where your mouth would be, and you can drink the water again. It's not exactly, when they first said that, I was like, ugh, oh God, I don't know if I guess I'm just so Americanized and just so used to living like a life where I just have clean drinking water that the idea of recycling my water and re-drinking it so that I don't die in the desert, that shit just sounded so disgusting to me, but it's what they have to do. So yes,
you gotta do, baby.
We haven't talked about the actual real point of this movie though, and I wanna get to that. So there's this resource called spice. And spice is only found on Arrakis. Arrakis is the planet that it's called Dune, right? So the whole movie is called Dune. The whole series is called Dune. It's based around this planet called Arrakis that has this resource called spice. Spice is a narcotic. It makes people have hallucinations, and it also extends your life. So to the people of Arrakis, the inhabitants, the people who are just indigenous to Arrakis, it's a sacred thing, this spice. And outsiders, foreigners who come there to mine it and to harvest it, they just want to use it because it allows their fucking space pilots to navigate interstellar travel. So that's like the whole thing is without spice, the people who are flying the ships to go from planet to planet, star to star, literally can't do it without being, I'll say for lack of a better word, high off of this spice. And what this spice does, if you're exposed to it long enough, it turns your eyes blue. So you see Zendaya's character, her name is Chani. You see her throughout the movie, although she doesn't actually appear until the very end, but you see her throughout the movie. She has these really, really deep blue eyes. And I don't mean blue as in just like how, you know, like some people just have actual blue eyes. Their entire eyeball is covered in the color blue. So it looks very, if you saw somebody like this in real life, it would actually freak you out a bit because there's no human that looks like that. Yeah. So it's a very exaggerated look. But their eyes are very blue because of exposure to the spice. And Paul is spice sensitive. So the main character who is, they pretty much portrayed that he is the one, right? Like, he wasn't supposed to be born. He was supposed to be a girl. But his mom chose to defy the Bene Gesserit's will. She created a boy, gave him the powers, taught him the voice. And he has all these visions. The movie opens with him having visions of the future. He constantly has visions. And the Reverend Mother, when he has that scene where he's tested by her, is told, you know, before it's being told to put your hand in a box, she asks him, "You've been having dreams, my boy." And he's like, yeah. She's like, do your dreams always come true exactly as you see them? And he says, no, which is a good thing, right? Because that means that there's not just one outcome to everything. Like he dreams multiple things and they don't always come true. So they confirm that early on.
It's interesting because it seems as though he gets visions from the future. And then obviously he like remembers it. And then, you know, like you said, it's good that it's not guaranteed to happen exactly the way it is. And to be fair, if you have visions from the future and then there's nothing you can do about it, then it's like, what's the point? Like,
what is the point? Just, yeah, just, you don't have free will at that point. So, like, everything you do is going to lead to that.
Yeah, so he can, whether willingly or unwillingly, he ends up manipulating the future a few times. Like,
yes.
For example, just as a quick example, he tells Duncan that, like, he's going to die. Like, he saw him dead.
Yep.
He finds the Fremen and he dies. And what's interesting is that like, that doesn't happen. And he's like, I need to go with you. But it's possible that just this simple act of him having that vision and then telling Duncan that changed he was going it. To die changed it. Because now, even though at the time when it happened, Duncan kind of like wrote it off and he was like, you know, whatever, like, I'm not going to die. But that could have stuck in his head or made him do things slightly differently.
Yes.
And then that ended up making just that little tiny thing made it so that he doesn't die.
Yeah, if you told me I was going to die meeting a group of people, I would probably be more cautious now, obviously, with my life. Yeah. Maybe I would be less aggressive. Maybe Duncan went in there, guns ablazing the first time. You know, in one timeline, that's how he goes in. He just goes in unknowingly, guns ablazing. I have to just put these people down because that's just what I'm instructed to do. Where in reality, and this is the cool thing about it, the Fremen, no one knows how many people there actually are. The Harkonnens who inhabited the planet before House Atreides got there thought that there were only 50,000 of them. Mm-hmm. Apparently, Duncan confirms that there are actually fucking millions of them. He went to one city out of hundreds of cities, and that one city had 10,000 people. And they asked him, how many cities are there? And he was like, hundreds. So he went to just one place, met Freeman one time, and there was 10,000 of them in this one pocket of the underground world. Because they only, again, the planet is just covered in sand. It's a fucking desert planet, and they speak about the heat often. It's so outrageously hot that plants don't grow there. Like, all the life there is basically just, if anything that's alive there can survive in extreme heat conditions, and there's not much.
Yeah, the only ones, so this is another thing that's really interesting, is the only people, the only greenery, the only plant life that exists, they exist because of the Fremens. They say that, like, whenever you see greenery, like, there's a part, I think Jessica says it, like, they spot greenery, and then they're like, oh, Fremens are there. This is toward the end of the movie. But, and then there's a part where they go to, like, a underground spot, and there's, like, greenery. Anyway, they make it clear that the only greenery that exists are because of the Fremens. And there's a part early in the movie when there's a guy tending to these palm trees.
Yeah.
And he's like, you know, these palm tree, one palm tree takes as much water as like five men would need in a day. There's 20 palm trees. And he was like, that's 100 lives, like that's a exactly day right. of water that's used on these palm trees. And then, so Paul, which I think is a noble thing to do, him being of a pretty honorable house, yeah. his father is very, throne. Yeah, and his father's very honorable. And like, you can tell that from certain events that happen. Paul's like, well, should we just save the water? Like, let's just give the water.
Yeah,
to the
people. He immediately, like, once he's told that, he immediately wants to get rid of the fucking trees. He's like, at that point, if we could save lives, or you better use this water, because water is a sacred resource on this planet. So when he finds out that 100 lives could basically be saved by getting rid of these trees that are kind of for show, he's like, yeah, let's fucking do it. Like, let's get rid of them. And the guy says, no, actually, it's best that we do keep the trees because they represent old dreams, like an old realm.
Yeah, yeah. And it's interesting because they show, like, they just show a lot of, not a lot, I guess, but there's a part where they go with Dr. Liat Kynes when they go to, like, this, and she says it's like the old ecology building. And that's been abandoned. And there's, like, greenery in there as well. And it makes it seem like, because she says, like, we had, like, a mission to, like, bring life to this planet. Like, I think she says Arrakis could have been a paradise. But then they discovered spice. And, like, that's when all the wars started and all this other shit.
Yep.
And, but, yeah, it's interesting because it seems as though, like, the dream of the Fremen, or, like, what they want to do is, like, they, a part of their various legends and lores that are passed down is to, like, make Arrakis a green planet, and they believe that they can do it, and like sort of fight, you know, not die from the desert.
They're doing, and they're doing such a good job. Yeah, when Duncan comes back from his meeting with the Fremen, and he was there for 4 weeks, and he learned so much. Like I said, he learned there are millions of them. When the Harkonnen, you know, they're fucking slow, so they thought that there were only 50,000 of them. I don't know how their numbers are that far off, but that just shows you how good the Fremen are at hiding the truth from them. The Fremen also are very hostile towards anyone who tries to harvest spice. So they naturally just kill people who come there to harvest. Like, that's just what they do. They're basically considered a thorn in the side of anyone who's tasked with going to this planet and mining spice. Like, the Fremen will just kill you if they see you. They do these little sneak attacks where you'll just be kind of standing on sand, and they show visions, and Paul's visions, you'll just see fucking Fremen come up out the sand out of nowhere and just stab you. Like, they're actually so broken. They're actually really, really cool.
They're absurdly strong fighters. There's a part, there's a really cool, and it's one of those things that it's not blatantly said, but it's like, they give you, like, dots and you just kind of connect them. But there's a part in the movie where they show the Sardaukon, or,
whatever they're called, the evil people, the Harkonnen people.
No, they're Saldakar. The people, yeah, they're the people that are part of the Emperor's army.
Saldakar.
Yeah. And they show them, and they say they have, like, three battalions going at the Harkonnen to, like, go kill House Atreides. Mm. And then the one guy's like, why do you even need us? Like, you guys outnumber Atreides. Like, you don't need the Emperor's army. And then one of the other, like, one of the dudes, he has, like, a black line on his lip. And somebody in House Atreides has a black line on their lip. I assume it's, like, a position. But he says that, like, they have Duncan and, what was the other guy's name?
Yeah, the guy who plays Thanos. Gurney.
Gurney, yeah. They were like, they have Duncan and Gurney. And they make it these two are fucked up. And you can't, like, they make it clear that these two are absurdly strong. Yes. And then they show, like, the Sardaukon, or whatever the fuck their names are, they're supposed to be, like, the most elite warriors in the Empire. Because, like, even there's a part where Duncan says, like, I fought these guys. And then Jessica's like, are you sure it was them? He's like, trust me, when you fight, like, if you fight them, you know it's them. And so anyway, my point is, all of that to say, when Duncan found the Fremen, he says that, like, he fought one of them, one-on-one, and he said, I've never come so close to dying in my life. So, like, the Fremen just in general are fucking broken.
Yeah, he says that they are the best fighters he's ever seen. They fight like demons.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is exactly what he says. He brings up the fact that they are literally the best fighters he's ever come across. So, House Atreides is revered as also a very strong warhouse. They control the, as his father puts it, as Paul's father puts it, House Atreides controls the land and the skies. They're very
good. The sea and the skies.
They're very, very good at fighting people, I guess, in those two territories. Like, they just basically have it down. And also, their actual fighters, like, their men are very, very good at fighting as well because of the two captains, like Duncan Idaho and Gurney Halleck. So those two people being on the side of House Atreides has made them a threat for a long time, it seems. And the Harkonnens just, they go through some kind of grueling training from age six. That's like on some Hitler Youth League type nonsense that makes them very vicious and very revered as fighters as well. But at the end of the day, the Baron didn't want to take any chances, and he decided to, you know, they have these three battalions of Saldakar come too. And they basically, it sucks because, you know, from the beginning, where this is going, I think when they're first ordered to leave, the Harkonnens are ordered by the Emperor to leave Arrakis and give it to House Atreides and let them be the new ones who are going to harvest the spice. And this pisses off the Harkonnens and one of the main ones, who's actually played by Batista.
Yeah.
So he's screaming at the Baron, who's like the main evil guy, this fat fuck. I don't even know what to call. He's just disgusting and looks scary as hell. But the Baron,
yo, I thought he was a worm.
He does, so like, when he first stands up and his gown gets really long.
Yeah, I was like, oh shit, he's a worm. And then he's not.
He's not.
But when I saw like his gown, the way he floated up, I was like, holy shit.
Yeah, he's creepy as hell looking. Very, very creepy. But Batista's yelling at him. He's saying, how dare everything that we built on this planet, they're just going to take it from us and give it to the House Atreides. Like, what the fuck? Like, how could the Emperor do this? And then the Baron just simply says very calmly, like, when is a gift not a gift?
Yeah.
And so as soon as I saw that, I was like, oh, God. And then he later on, the Baron even says, the Emperor is a very jealous man. And Leto, like the, you know, the leader of House Atreides, has grown in popularity. People love him all throughout the universe. He's a very liked person. And they're afraid, it's just a power thing. They're afraid of his influence that one day, you know, maybe people will rise up, or if he ever wanted to rebel against the Emperor or something like that, people would actually support his cause. So he's viewed as a threat. Because he's such an honorable and noble man, and he's liked by everyone. So the Emperor actually sets up this ploy to pull the Harkonnens off of Arrakis and have House Atreides go there, so that way they can just back attack them and kill them. They were actually sent on a, what I refer to as a dummy mission. When the Harkonnens left, they actually left the place in such a bad spot where House Atreides really couldn't even do their job anyway. All of the equipment that they left there, they don't have the proper resources or tools to actually mine the spice. So they're sent there to do this. Like, it's like your boss is telling you, I need you to do this for me, and I'm taking it from this guy, I'm giving it to you. But when they do that, they don't give you a fucking laptop. They're like, I want you to just like come up with these numbers, come up with these figures. Like, I'm speaking in terms of myself because I'm an accountant. Like, imagine having to do my job without fucking Microsoft Excel. Like, here's a laptop, but it doesn't have the internet. It doesn't have Microsoft Excel, but I still want you to do the exact same job that the guy before you did, who had these things. He had the internet and he had Excel. I want you to do that without it.
They show up and there's like a bunch of silos, and you see, let's just say there's 10 silos, like 10 sections, and each of the 10 have like 10 little silos you can put on them. They're all empty except for like one. And it's just like, okay. Like, they emptied out everything, and then they, in my opinion, clearly sabotaged the other equipment, even the little equipment that was left. There's a part where they go out, and there's like this giant beetle-looking machine that is mining the spice. And then, like, the worm is coming, and they send, like, this, I don't know, not a helicopter, but they send, like, this helicopter thing to, like, go down and save it. And then, like, one of the things breaks, and it, like, it's all doesn't fucked. Work. And it's like, dude, that shit was sabotage. And then even Liet Kynes, like, who I would say is arguably a neutral party in this, but she was also commanded to, like, she knew that things were fucked up. But she's like, oh, no, like, that was just old. Like, the desert's not kind to equipment. And it's like, man, that's bullshit. Like, you know it was sabotaged.
Yeah. So they've been sent to do this dummy mission, and it's not a good look. As soon as they get there, Paul's dad, he realizes exactly what's going on. And he's not, you know, they're not stupid. They're like, God damn it. The Emperor is sabotaging us. Like, we're being told to go here. They even say, there's this one line about living on Arrakis, you know, in order to shower, you have to wipe your ass with sand. Like, that's pretty much the only way to clean yourself on Arrakis. Because the water is that, it's that hard to find water on this planet. And there's even parts where they have to close the doors because it's that hot. Like, they have to seal off all the doors, they say, because the sun is at its peak and it's just too hot to have that level of heat coming in indoors where they live in like this gigantic pyramid. So it's all bad. It's real bad.
It's interesting too, though, because right from the, so it's interesting because obviously we'll learn, I guess, more later. It's done in a way where clearly they don't want you to know. The Emperor's not even shown. They don't want you to know the full scope of what the Emperor has planned. But when the movie starts, like pretty much from the beginning, everybody already knows that it's a trap. Like, yes. There's a part where the All Mother basically says, Paul, like, I hope you survive. There's a part where Paul and his dad are talking, and he's talking about going there. And then Paul says, like, you know, they were told to go to Arrakis. And Paul kind of once again is like, oh, why? So we can just be, the like, essentially their new slave masters. Like, we're not going to be any better than the Harkonnens.
Yeah.
Because he's like. But then Paul's dad also says,
wants to fight. Like, he wants to be on the front lines. He's the kind of kid who's naturally a rebel. He doesn't really want to just sit there and be the heir to the throne and that's it. Like, he actually, he knows how to fight. He wants to go out and actually help and do things. Like, he doesn't want to be just a son who lives a lavish life and is always kind of coddled by his parents because he was born into riches. Like, that's not what he wants to do.
And he can scrap. Like, I mean, to be fair, he's been trained by Duncan and Gurney.
Yep.
He's been trained by them, and then later on you realize he's just even more broken because he can just cheat and see the future.
Yes.
And he can kind of, like, he can do this thing where you know, he can lose the fight 3 million times in his in the future and then learn how to win.
Yeah, it's actually so absurd that voice ability, the Bene Gesserit powers that he has, the visions, the dream, all of that stuff. It all culminates into making him the most broken individual on the planet. And so in a fight, he can literally kind of Sharingan you. He can see what you're going to do before you do it. And then it makes it where he can't be beat. Like, in a one-on-one fight, you really can't beat him. And they showed that at the very end of the movie when he fights against a guy named Jameis. But yeah, the movie does a good job of basically portraying the strained relationship between House Atreides and Harkonnens, who are actually related. The trap set by the Emperor and the Baron for House Atreides. And then eventually it all culminates into a night attack after they do their first, you know, excavation mission where they go to save that one machine that's kind of harvesting spice. When they get back that night, they're attacked and they just got there. Like, this is, I want to almost say this is like the first week of them being there and they get attacked immediately.
It does happen pretty quick.
They don't let them get their bearings on this planet at all. They don't even get to deliver spice. Like, the dad is still wondering, you know, at the end of the day, I need to deliver spice. And if I don't, it's going to be a bad job. Like, it's going to be bad. So I need to get shit running and up and running on this planet. And you're not helping. He's saying that to the doctor. And she's like, I don't really care about that. Like, that's not really my job. That part, like, that has nothing to do with me. But yeah, I'm gonna just give you the ropes of how the desert works. Like, I'm just here to help you to learn how the desert works, but I'm not here to actually help you fix this equipment. If they sabotage you, that's your problem, not mine. But it's very clear that this entire house has been fucking set up to die and be killed, and by a jealous Emperor and the Baron, the leader of the Harkonnens.
Yeah, it's interesting because like, once again, they go into this knowing that it's a trap. Like, before they even go there, they make it clear that most of the House Atreides already knows it's a setup. But they get there, and the big thing is they thought they had more time. Because they get there, and there's a part where, I don't remember his name, but he's like kind of a fat guy. And he's the other guy with like the black line on his lip.
I know exactly what you're talking about. He's played by like a light-skinned black gentleman, and he's kind of chubby, right? Yeah, he always lets Leto know if someone's coming. He's like, oh, they just arrived, or oh, there was 1.4 million people and stuff like that.
He's like, he's like a bastion of knowledge.
Yeah.
So there's a part where they're talking. I think it's after Duncan comes back and they find out that there's millions of Fremen. And that's when and the Harkonnens thought there was 50,000. So they look at each other, Leto and this other guy, this like fat gentleman. I don't remember his name, unfortunately. But he basically says, like, we were right. And so, like, the plan will work. It'll just take time. And so, like, you know, they say a couple times throughout the movie, like, to cultivate desert power, which is just, like, to work with an ally with the Fremen because of how powerful they are, etc., and how many they are. And so their whole plan was to come here, even though they knew it was a trap. But for some reason, they had some information. Like, the fat guy seemed to have known that he knew there was more than 50,000. He was like, that was like kind of part of their plan, and they were setting shit up. I don't know, it's really interesting. Like, the movie does things where it puts these really like kind of subtle plot points or like subtle things in there, and you kind of just have to like extrapolate on them. As it goes on and figure things out.
So pretty early on, there's an assassination attempt made at Paul, which I thought was pretty interesting. They send in this fucking little wasp looking thing. It looks like an insect flying in.
He called it a hunter seeker.
Yeah. He's watching, you know, some kind of documentary, essentially. He's watching a documentary, just chilling, you know, big chilling in his room. And he kind of gets up off of pure, just, I guess, instinct to go look at the documentary a bit closer. But as he does that, there's a hole directly behind where his back was at. And you see this little tiny wasp looking thing with a pointed nose, like a stinger on a nose. And it comes out, he turns around and sees it. And it's almost like the thing is looking for him, but it doesn't quite know where he's at yet. So he's staring at it move throughout the room. And it's just kind of like doing its own thing. And he's quiet. He kind of fades into the shadows. And then it notices him and it gets really, really close to his face. And then the second somebody opens the door to come into his room, the thing kind of like jabs forward almost to kill him. And he kind of moves to the side and grabs it. So I'm assuming that he used his premonition ability there because it was like perfect timing the way he did that. Or just, you know, the fact that he can actually fight. But a combination of all those things, again, makes him very, very formidable just when you're trying to kill him, I guess, because it seems to be very difficult to do so. So he dodges it, he grabs it, and then his dad is pissed. Obviously, this is a big deal. They just tried to kill the prince. They look throughout the walls because to control that wasp, you have to be pretty close to it, they say.
Yep.
So they destroyed the walls and they found out that there was a Harkonnen left in the walls weeks ago, like before they ever arrived. And he had been living off of like water and a still suit. You see like the coil wrapped around his body so that he could survive in the wall without any food or water or anything, that like just what he had. Very dedicated assassin. So he's been in the walls for a very, very abnormally long amount of time just for this mission to kill someone, like to kill Paul, to kill, you know, someone in the royal house of Atreides. And he fails. They kill him, of course. But yeah, then Duncan goes out. Duncan comes back with one of the Fremen leaders. And it's a really awkward scene where they meet Leto and they like spit on the ground in front of him. It looks like a sign of disrespect because that's how pretty much every other culture looks at spitting on the ground in front of somebody. But apparently, because moisture and because water is such a coveted resource on Arrakis, it's actually considered a sign of respect. In fact,
yep.
It's actually the highest form of respect to give somebody the moisture from your body, as they put it.
Yeah.
So you spit back. That's a sign that I highly respect you.
It's very cool too, because it's one of those things where any reader or watcher, and like, they would look at that and be like, oh, obviously that's a sign of disrespect, like he just spit on the floor. But when you take into the context that they literally live on a desert planet where the sun, when it reaches its peak in the sky, like you can't even be outside for 2 hours without dying.
Yeah.
When you think about, there's no water, like how coveted water is as a resource.
Yes.
It's actually a very interesting take on it, that like water has so much value, like spitting, that's you giving up some of that water, of the resource. So it's such a cool thing, because if you were like really smart, you might be able to figure it out ahead of time. You know what I mean? Because that's how important water is.
Yeah.
It's that, but like most people are going to be like, they'll get taken for the loop. But it is something that makes complete sense.
You see his soldiers and his guards pull their weapons and everything. Like, they're ready to fight when they see that guy spit. And then they're like, hold up. Duncan tells him, like, yo, chill. And this is actually a big sign of respect. You always spit when you respect somebody. You're like, you know what I mean? So that is pretty cool how to use it. Water is so sacred. There's a scene in this movie with a little tiny critter that looks like he is a mouse. They just show him, like, once or twice throughout the movie, they just showed his little critter. And they zoom in on it at one point, and you see that it's sweating from its ears.
Yeah.
And it grabs, it like swipes the sweat from its ear and like puts it in its mouth.
Yeah, it literally grabs the sweat and drinks it. It's and crazy.
So I love that because that shows you how the influence of stillsuits, that's pretty much how they came to be. The idea of reusing the moisture that is leaving your body, and like the animal literally did what a stillsuit does. It recycled the water. I'm sweating, I'm going to use this and drink it because I want to return it to my body as opposed to letting it like fall in the sand and just be lost.
Yeah, so it's cool. An animal, so you know it did it just so instinctually. Yes. You know what I mean?
It's so cool, and like it's a made up creature. It's not an actual monster. It actually looks kind of decent. Like it looks like something that I wouldn't be scared of in real life. Like the same way when I look at a squirrel, I'm not exactly afraid of squirrels. Like I kind of see them. If I see a mouse, I'm freaked out. If I see a rat, I'm freaked out. Possum, anything like that. But yeah, this little thing
was kind of like a mouse rabbit, right?
Yeah,
like
it was a mouse rabbit.
Yeah,
it has big ears, but it has the body of a mouse. I don't know. It was just cute. It was a cute little thing. You see it like drinking its own little sweat. It's disgusting, yeah. But as soon as I saw it, I said, oh, that's where they got the idea of stillsuits. That's pretty much how humans are in general. We learn from animals and from the environment how to do things. It's pretty much how everything is inspired. When we watch beavers make dams, right? Like, that's what beavers do. And then what do? We took and did it in the industrial way. But yeah, so you find out little things like that, little world building like that. I love it's a really quick shot when they show that little animal do that. And I was like, oh, okay. So there's stuff like that going on. But yeah, so the night attack happens and his dad is killed, not immediately, but you found out that their doctor betrayed them. So there's like this Asian doctor and he had been like checking the prince's vitals throughout the movie and just kind of giving little words of advice and stuff like that here and there. But come to find out, he's the guy that lowered the shields of House Atreides on the planet. And he also essentially allowed the sneak attack to go through. And when
he also messed the comms up, he like jammed the comms.
Yeah,
it gets revealed. Because when they first land, they talk about how, like, their comms are fucked up. And they're like, we can't get through. Like, our comms are messed up. And they're just, like, kind of pissed.
Yeah, so he sabotaged everything. And when the father has been caught by one of those hunter-seeker things, it actually stabs him in the back. And it puts him down immediately. So you see what it would have done to Paul. It doesn't kill him right away, but he is out of commission for the rest. Like, that one thing put him out of commission for the entire duration of his life from that point on. And the Asian guy walks up to him, the doctor, and he says to him, he's like, why did you do it? He's like, well, they have my wife. And he's like, but I promise you that I will do everything I can for your son. So, like, I'm going to help out Paul, but, like, your life and your family's life, the rest of you guys, I had to fuck over because they had my wife. And so it's one of those things that really does suck, but I kind of get it, right, in a sense of, like, you know, someone's wife is captive by the Harkonnens. Like, the Baron has this guy's wife. And he's doing what he can to save his family, but it's at the cost of, you know, backstabbing his current king. It's just a really Game of Thronesy sticky situation.
So this is to talk about like a small complaint I have. Basically, this is when. So first of all, I think the movie's very watchable. I watched it twice, and you said you watched it twice, and it's you can tell me what you think. I felt like the movie. It's 2.5 hours long, right? But it's very watchable. Like, it doesn't feel like a drag to watch. Like,
no, I don't have a problem watching this movie at all.
Yeah, like, the movie flows really well. And, like, on rewatch, you know, you notice things that you didn't notice before. But, I don't know, the movie's very watchable. I really do like it. And so, like, I get things like that. The point that I'm trying to get to is I do wish that it was, like, a 4-hour movie, like Lord of the Rings. Or, again, like I always say, like, because, you know, all the Lord of the Rings movies are like 4 hours or, you know, just like a series of episodes. And it's only because no matter how much you put into the movie, when adapting such a large book, obviously there's things that you leave out. And I just, with Dr. Yue, now this isn't coming from any book knowledge, because like I said, I listened to the audiobook a really long time ago, and I don't even remember Dr. Yue. So this isn't like anything I remember from the book. But in the movie, he has like 2 scenes. And then he's the traitor. And it's like, I just wish the movie's a bit longer to like give more characters time to breathe so that we can be with Dr. Yue more. That way the treachery.
I this at all, but I see what you mean.
That way the treachery like hits you harder. You know what I mean?
Because I didn't feel anything when I saw it. I'll tell you that.
Yeah. So like when the treachery happened, on one end, I was like, man, that sucks. But I was only saying that because it was like the guys I'm rooting for got betrayed.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Not
because you know who Yue is. You know how close he is to the prince and to the dad and everything like that.
Yeah.
It doesn't really mean much to know that this guy betrayed someone.
Yeah. Like Dr. Yue seems like a very important character based on what we do see. But on top of that, what we do see is just kind of him like giving the prince a checkup 2 times. And like,
and also he doesn't live very long after that. So after he does betray House Atreides, he goes to the Baron to get his reward, and the Baron's like, what did I promise you again? And he's like, I did everything you asked me. I sabotaged their comms. I fucking lowered their shields. He's like, yes, the bargain to the very, to the, like, the T, right? Like, you did everything to the T, exactly what you were supposed to do. And what was I supposed to give you for it? And he's like, you're supposed to free my wife of her agony or whatever. And he's like, oh, yes. Yeah. And he floats over to him, and he cuts his head off.
Yeah, he says, like I promised you would be together or whatever. And he's like, so join her. And then he kills him.
Yeah, he slices him. And, it's just assumed, like, all right, he beheaded him or whatever. And then he looks down at his cousin. And, Leto, when he says, what do you think is going to happen next, cousin? And it kind of switches the scene. And then a cool thing is that Dr. Yue, before he, like, the whole time when he told him, I'm going to do what I can for Paul, he gave him this cyanide pill that apparently kills everybody in the room. It, like, you bite down on it and it releases this toxic gas that you can exhale. And, of course, you will die, but it will also kill everyone around you, which seems so outrageously broken because of how fast it works.
Dude. They immediately started choking and dying and shit. Like, it was so fast
that I said, there's no fucking way I would give that to somebody. Because if I just backstabbed you, right? Like, think about that. I just backstabbed you. I just traded on you. And I'm giving you a pill that can kill everybody in the vicinity. And I'm in the vicinity. There's no way. So I was like, that seems a bit wild to me. But, like, I just kind of gloss over that little detail. Because, like, you're not going to use it on me. You want to use it on the Baron. And that's kind of what he was instructing him to do. Like, yeah, you're going to die, but at least your last breath can also be the last breath of the Baron. And so he does try to use it on the Baron, and it works on everybody else in the room, but then the Baron does some fucking evil magic shit and goes up to the ceiling, and he doesn't die from it. But it does hurt him.
Right? The technology of, because they say it's like year fucking like 10,200. Like, it's way in the future.
Yeah.
And, so, there's absurd technology. Obviously, there's travel between planets. But, like, this fat guy, I almost assume to the point he's so fat and, like, such a lard that he can't even really move on his own. It's also possible, like you said earlier, that spice extends your life. And being that he's in charge of gathering spice, that he's used spice to live a little bit longer than he should, making it so that on top of him being fat, on top of him maybe being very old, it's hard for him to move around. But he has, like, this flotation technology that he uses at all times. Like, it doesn't seem like he can really even get around without it.
Yeah, I also say this. So I know this from watching, like, random YouTube videos and just researching the Dune lore. But he is actually in that condition because of the Bene Gesserit. They actually sabotaged him. I think it was actually the Reverend Mother, too, the main one.
Oh, interesting.
She actually did that to him. He used to be beautiful and young and had a body like Batista and those guys, like the generals. Like, he used to be just like that, and apparently kind of good looking, but for whatever reason, the Bene Gesserit decided to do that to him and made him this fat, nasty, like, gluttonous person that lost all his hair, lost his beautiful body, can barely move around without that flotation thing. And yeah, they just kind of turned him into a creature, but it was on purpose, and it was for a reason of this greater timeline thing, the golden timeline. Like, everything that the Bene Gesserit does is for that purpose. It's they don't really waste using their abilities and the manipulation powers for no reason. They don't just do it for their own benefit. They do it kind of to promote this, like, world where people are going to live the best they ever could possibly live. So that's, like, a little thing that I only know because of, like, researching YouTube. It's not in the movie.
They get, like, a bad rap from everybody in the series. Like, it seems like nobody really likes them or trusts them. Like, in a weird way, they have a high position. They have a high position, right? Like, the Emperor has, like, a member of the Bene Gesserit, the leader of House Atreides. They get these high positions, but in these high positions, it also seems as though no one trusts them.
Yeah.
And so they're like, let's say, a shadow government, right? And so, as untrustworthy as they are, and as much as blah, 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 it does seem as though that their motives are noble. Like, it doesn't seem like they're evil. It doesn't seem like they're evil. It seems as though that they are really trying to do something for the betterment of the universe.
Yes, that is definitely the case that I got from it, too. They look more evil than they are. Like, they're dressed all black and have veils. If you saw these people, you would assume naturally that they are bad guys. But they actually apparently are not. From what I understand, they're actually good people. So, there's that. They just happen to have these ridiculous abilities that I think are so cool. Again, I cannot get over that voice and the whole just being able to tell somebody what to do. And after the night attack, like, House Atreides is virtually wiped out. Dad dies. The rest of everyone dies. Like, His trainer dies.
Gurney or Duncan?
Yeah, Gurney dies. Duncan.
Do we see Gurney die?
Okay.
Because I know we see Duncan die, and Duncan goes out like a goddamn fucking champion.
We do see Duncan die. So the first time Duncan gets like jumped, you don't see what happens to him, but they kind of make it seem like he might die. And then come to find out he didn't, and then he gets jumped later on again, and he actually dies right there, 100%. We don't really see Gurney die, you're right. So it's likely that he could actually be alive in later movies. But the last you see him, the odds against him are so bad that it looks...
The odds are bad, but right now in my head lore, he's equal to Duncan, just because of the way they talked about the two of them. Yeah. And I watched Duncan solo like 17 of them.
He did solo legit... a fucking score of those people. So he's apparently very broken. When they show him going against the Saldakar and the Harkonnens, they're so outnumbered that it's kind of implied, but again, they didn't show his death on screen, so for that purpose, he probably is actually still alive. So after the night attacks happen and House Atreides is virtually wiped out, you get to a point where his mom, because the Baron did promise that he would not harm Paul and Jess. So the Reverend Mother is speaking to the Baron.
Dude, I think this is such a bad plan. Like, I don't agree. I think this plan does not work, but go ahead.
So the Bene Gesserit, like the Reverend Mother is like, yo, you can do whatever you want to everyone else, but just we have certain conditions and certain things that we are asking of you. Do not kill Paul and do not kill Jess, his mom. And the Baron's like, absolutely, I won't do those things. And as soon as the Bene Gesserit lady leaves, their little, I guess... I don't know what the assistant dude, he's like, yo, what the fuck? Like, why would you not kill them? He's like, I said that I wouldn't kill them myself, but what we will do is kind of throw them out in the desert and they can't possibly survive out there. So it's the same thing as except I didn't kill them. I just kind of put them in a condition where they can't survive. So he finds a way around it. Like, he's so sneaky. And this is his workaround to still find a way to kill Paul and his mom. So I was like, okay, I get it.
This plan to me just seems so bad because we find out that she is what they call the truth seer or the truth seer.
Truth sayer of the emperor, yes.
Something like that. Yeah, I wasn't sure. But anyway, she's like, apparently she can like tell, she knows if you're telling the truth, right? Or she can see the truth, see through lies, all that stuff. And we also just know she's fucking broken.
Yes.
We also know that she's absurdly powerful with the voice. So even if you do lie to her, I feel like she could just say, tell me what happened. And then, like, you would just tell her what happened, and you wouldn't even know that you did it. So it's just like they have this plan where they're like, well, I'm not the one that killed them. Yeah. I'm just going to set it up so that they die. And I'm looking at this, and, like, obviously, I know Paul's the main character and that, like, he's not going to die.
Not yet.
I did think maybe his mom would die, but.
Me too. I was surprised that she actually made it through this entire ordeal.
Same. I
thought for sure she was dead.
I thought she was going to die. I thought she was going to die, and then he would, you know, make it to the end. But she doesn't die either. But my whole thing is, I think their plan was so bad. Like, if I promise this lady that I'm not killing
him. You're talking about the Baron, right?
I'm sorry. The Baron and the Harkonnen. Like, his plan to, like, I'm not going to be the one that kill him, but I will make sure they die.
Because I get what you're saying, but I do wonder if that's how you have to lie to the Bene Gesserit. You have to do it in a way like that. Because I wonder if their abilities, obviously their abilities are not 100% all-knowing, all-powerful, because she had to ask Paul questions like, do your dreams always come true? So they're not all-knowing, thankfully, because they would just be entirely too powerful. So there's still things that I guess I want to say are hidden from their third eye. Like, there are things that you can actually get off that they might not be privy to. For example, like the fact that she decided to just have a son instead of having a daughter, like stuff like that. Like, they didn't predict that this was going to happen. She kind of defied. She went against it and is like, well, fuck, that wasn't part of the plan. So I wonder if when the Baron lies and says, I'm not killing them. And he really isn't. He just is putting him in a situation where they couldn't possibly survive. It's like a weird workaround. And like you said, it's not exactly the most sound plan, but I feel like if this movie was 4 hours, they might have a chance to explain there are ways to get around their sight. Like, I feel like that would be scene or something that the Baron says when she walks away. Like, those witches think they know everything, but there's blind spots in their visions. Something like that.
Yeah. It's just one of those things where I feel like you could just word the question. Like, if the question is just to, like, word it, like, were you in any way responsible for Paul's death? And it's like, now what do you say?
Yeah,
like,
yeah, if you, yeah.
like,
It's like, Kenny, you've been playing too much. What's that game with the attorney, Ace Attorney or whatever?
Oh, yeah, Phoenix Wright Ace Attorney.
Phoenix Wright, yeah. You've been playing, like, so much of that. You're like, yeah.
That's my thing, though. Like semantics. Because that's the way I think of that shit. Like, the semantics and stuff, like...
Yeah, well, don't ever have kids, because when they try to lie to you, you're going to be you're gonna be awful to them.
Dude, I get into the semantics of that stuff so much.
Like, your kids are going to try to be clever, and you're not going to be having it at all.
Not at all. Because, like, he's acting like the question he's going to get asked is, did you kill her?
Yeah, and it's like, motherfucker,
that's not the question I'm going to ask.
Right. Like, did you aid in the death of Paul and Jess? And there's only one answer to that question. Like, earlier in the movie, there's another scene where Jess, Paul's mom, is choosing to, like a housekeeper. And she chooses a woman. She makes all the other ones leave. And the woman has a Chris knife on her. So she's like, I know right now. And Jess, the Bene Gesserit, she has this ability where, again, they just have so many abilities. But she just knows that this woman is armed with a weapon. She's like, I know right now on your hip is a Chris knife.
Yeah, that's one of those things where I don't know if it was, let's say, magic. I don't know if it was part of, like, her way that she knew that she was armed. Or if it's just the fact, you know how in action movies, some people will just know, like, you have a gun on your ankle. Because they're, like, so well-trained in combat. I don't know if it was, like, part of her magic power that she knew she was armed, or the fact that, randomly, Jessica, and I assume the rest of the Bene Gesserit, are fucking boxers. Like, they can fight. Like, yeah. You find out later, like, she can legit fight. Like, it wasn't just because of the voice.
Yeah.
That, earlier in the movie, when she said, your mom's guarding the door, no one will make it past her.
Yeah.
It's not just because of the voice. She will beat your, like, she can fight.
Yeah,
so,
I do think that it is part of the Bene Gesserit, like, ability, though, that they just know things that they are not blatantly told.
Mm-hmm.
So when she says that, I'm just going to chalk it up to that. But that, regardless, that's not their here nor there. She says, like, you have a cursed knife on you, like, it's on your hip, and the woman reveals it. And then her guard, she's also doing sign language at the same exact time with her hands.
Yeah, yeah.
So her guard, she's like, be prepared for violence. She tells her guard with her fingers, which I think is so cool that she's speaking two languages at once. I think that in itself is such a cool feat to me. Like, you can speak
sign language is so unfair. Like,
it's so broken.
When you think about it in a tactical sense, it's so unfair. Like, it happened multiple times in the movie where she's in a situation and then they use sign language secretly to, like, you know, convey information.
Yeah, I'll talk about that right after this. So yeah, she uses sign language to her guard. She's like, be prepared for violence. And the woman pulls the knife out, but she doesn't use it in an aggressive way. She kind of makes this loud scream type of noise. And she says something along the lines of, to live your whole life hearing about these prophecies and to know that they're so close to coming true is overwhelming. And that's what made her kind of yell out. And, like, this, it's like a religious yell.
Though. Yeah.
It's like, yeah, I'm close to God type of yell. That's what it gave me, that vibe. And so when she does
I was going to say, that's what I was, like, talking about earlier, in that it seems to me that she's talking about this prophecy and then, like, this arrival of Paul and his mother. And, you know, they say, like, the prophecy of the mother and the son. It seems as though, like, this is part of the Bene Gesserit, like, her being part of, like, this religious, her believing this religious prophecy. It's not something that the Bene Gesserit did in 4 days because they realized that they're going to Arrakis. This is something that they've done over time, right?
Yes.
Like, it seems as though they've embedded this religion, and it's like, so that future members of the Bene Gesserit will be able to continue that manipulation.
They even say that they have been crossing bloodlines for centuries to get to this point.
Yeah.
So they've been, like, choosing exactly who's going to breed with who. For example, Jess and Leto are not even married.
Like, they're not.
Like, that's considered his concubine or whatever, as the Baron puts it. So it's really interesting because I just assumed that, like, oh, his parents are married. Like, they're...
I also assume they were married until, obviously, she gets called a concubine. And then, like, the night before Leto dies...
He says, I should have married you.
Yeah, he says, like, I should have married
you. So she was literally supposed to be just someone to give him an heir. But, you know, the Bene Gesserit didn't want him to have a son. They want him to just have daughters so that he doesn't have a proper heir. And, yeah, come to find out, you know, not even married. There's just a lot of cool things with that whole lore as well. And apparently she fell in love with him. So Jess fell in love with Leto, and that's why she gave him a son. You know, this is another thing that I found out from my YouTube research, because they don't illicitly say it, I feel like. But that's the reason why she defies the Bene Gesserit rule of, like, don't let him bring in a son.
They don't. Yeah, I don't think you ever hear them say, like, I love you to each other. But in that, you know, in that scene, once again, one of those small nitpicks where it's like, man, I wish this movie was 4 hours, right? Where I realized that, like, that's the only scene they have together. Like, I wish I got to once again see them spend more time together. Yeah. But regardless,
his mom is pregnant too.
Yeah, but in that last scene, I did feel as though she, like, I did, even though they really only had one scene, I did feel as though they loved each other.
Yeah, it was that one scene, but you knew from that scene where he kind of rests his head between her legs and she starts to massage his head.
Yeah.
And he's like, this is, you know, this is where I want you to be right now. He just needs, he's so stressed out. The task he's been given, again, is just a fucked up one. It's a sabotage one. He's aware of it. She's aware of it. Everyone knows it. It's kind of one of those things like, all right, we're making the best out of a fucked situation here. And he's the guy, he's the leader. So when you're the leader and you're responsible for all these other people and everything, it just sucks. The heavy is the head that wears the crown. So he's just stressed out.
Yeah, I think she offers to give him what, this isn't like explicitly stated even what this is, but there's like a little pill, like a drug that I think they take to go to sleep.
Yeah.
Because Paul takes one before he goes to bed. Not that we see him take it, but Dr. Yue brings it in and gives it to him, like on a tray. And then that same tray is in their room, Leto and Jessica's room. And I think, although I don't feel like I heard exactly, I feel like she offers to give him the pill so he can go to sleep and he denies it. And that's when he says, like, that's when he like lays on her lap. But because what's interesting is that she and Paul, for example, they sleep through most of the attack, whereas Leto wakes up. And I think it's because like he didn't take that drug that they use to help sleep. Yeah. You know what I mean? But it's just interesting because I wonder if the main reason why he didn't take it, like he was stressed and it's like, it seemed like he felt like things were going bad. So like, he didn't take the sleeping pill.
Yeah. You need to be aware. Like, yeah, I think that there's definitely something to be said about that. Like, he was just kind of privy to it. I mean, he's a smart guy. He's been leading this house for a long time. He's a very honorable, looked revered person. Like, he makes good decisions. And he's like, at this current time, I need to be alert. I need to be able to come to my senses at any quick moment because you don't know what the fuck is really going on. This is also, again, I don't know if it's their first night, but I feel like it's given first night there. So, like, I need to be still on my P's and Q's here.
Yeah, I don't think it's their first night. It's hard to tell how much time has passed, but yeah, like it is.
They only really show like one nightfall, and the first nightfall they show is when they get attacked. I feel like
because so much stuff happens where it's like I like it can't be their first night, right? But I mean, I guess it might be.
Yeah, this could have all legit. Like again, I don't know. But when I watched it again today, it did seem like there wasn't much of a transition from like day to day. It was just like, all right, we landed here. We're going to go out to go see the, see different places and stuff like that. But like you said, there's no, because it's how much happens, unless they start at the top of the morning and this just all went in for like a really, really long day. I doubt that it was all one day, but I think that the point is the fact that that Kenny and I can't tell if it's one day means that it does happen quickly.
It is quickly. Yeah, it is quickly. It doesn't feel as though regardless if it's a day or a week, it's not much. It's not a month. I know that.
Definitely not a month because he needs to get spice delivered and he never gets spice delivered. So let's just be clear. This happens so fast that it's either one day or like a couple days at most.
Yeah.
And so the director wanted to make it clear that this happens quick. They get sent their Arrakis and they get attacked in less than a fortnight. And so, yeah, Paul and his mom, they survive. They're on this fucking flying dragonfly. That's how
I love their like dragonfly helicopter. It looks so cool. They are so sick.
As I was watching the movie, I was like, I wonder if that could be possible because it looks so much better than a helicopter. Like obviously helicopters are also inspired by dragonflies too. They look exactly the same, but this one, instead of having a propeller on the top spinning around in a circle, it has actual dragonfly wings, like four wings, and it kind of like flutter and that's how it flies. But it makes a really cool sound like an actual insect and it looks cool too. So they're on one of those things and they're surrounded by Harkonnen. And his mom is gagged because of her ability, but Paul is not. And again, this goes back to them not knowing that Paul can actually use the voice. So the second the mom looks over at Paul, she says, "Don't do it. You're not well trained in it yet." Right? Like, don't, like, she knows he's planning to use the voice.
Using the sign language.
Yep. Using sign language. She's speaking to him and she's like, "Don't do it." Right? Like, you're going to fuck this up. And he tries it anyway. He's like, "Remove her gag." And the fucking one Harkonnen just like backhands him. He's like, "Shut the fuck up." And his mom is like, "Your pitch was off." You know what I mean? Like, this is like, at this point, she's like, "All right, fuck it. If you're going to do it, let me like help you, right? Like, your pitch was off." So she tells him his pitch was off. And then they're like, how about we throw him out? Like, they just randomly is like, yo, let's just throw him out. Then they start having this little small talk about, I've never been with a highborn woman before.
Yeah, they just start blatantly talking about raping Jessica.
They like insinuate rape, and it's really dark. And I was like, okay, like, what the fuck? But this is the type of shit that always happens. I swear, if you just let men, I guess, attack and pillage any kind of civilization, there's always going to be that. Like, I guess that just is a natural thing that happens. In Game of Thrones, they even say, like, when men get the heat of battle on them, they become like frenzied in the mind, like wild animals.
Yeah.
And so they start saying this. They start saying, like, I've never been with a highborn woman before. And so that's when Paul gets pissed, because, like, you're not just going to say this about my mom in front of me. Like, that's wild. So he's like, remove her gag. He gets backhanded. They talk about throwing him out. And then as the guy, like, gets up, he gets in Paul's face and he like opens the door to the helicopter thing. And so now, like, you can see the desert below them. And Paul looks up at him. He's like, remove her gag. And the actual voice happens this time. And he actually removes the gag. And then as soon as he removes the gag, the mom starts using the voice. She's like, kill him. And he immediately just kills him.
Untie us. Yes. Stop. Like, she just starts.
Yes, like, she's broken. Her voice is so, like, blatant. And mind you, what I thought was cool is that when Paul was using the voice, it was super quiet because the doors were closed. When she does it, the door is open and it's loud as hell now. Like, imagine being in an airplane and there's a door open. Like, yeah. It's super loud, but it just shows you how powerful her voice ability is over, like, Paul's at the time, because hers transcends the sound that's in the cockpit. But yeah, she gives all of these wild commands, like Kenny just said, and they all happen immediately. Like, everything she says happens immediately.
Yeah, she definitely is practiced, right? Like, she doesn't have the issues Paul has, right? But to be fair, I think Paul is 15. You know, he's young, still learning. And he's not, you know, he's not even supposed to be learning this, right? As my understanding of this, right, the Bene Gesserit, they are trained, like, they go through a training. And because he's a boy, and also because he wasn't even supposed to be born,
right?
He's only being trained by his mom and probably not getting the same training she got. You know what I mean? So it's going to take him a bit longer. The Reverend Mother,
they confirmed that early on, that, like, the person that trained her was actually the highest fucking Bene Gesserit in the land. So yeah. His mom is broken. That's why, like, I like the hierarchy of this whole thing. It's like, okay, you have the woman above her, but then his mom is apparently very, very good too.
Yeah, I mean, it was really cool early in the movie when the All-Mother was, like, talking to Paul and saying, like, whatever. And she was saying that, like, you know, because you're birth. And he was like, oh, because I'm the Duke's son. And she was like, no, because you're Jessica's son. And it's like, okay.
Yeah. there was a quick little thing in the movie where the Reverend Mother says, you have two birthrights, my boy. So that was kind of an allusion to the fact that not only are you House Atreides' heir, but you're also the heir of, like, this great power that the Bene Gesserit have been passing down. They use these really elaborate terms that I'm not even going to try to repeat what they say, but basically they all allude to him being the one, quote unquote.
Yeah, yeah.
They have all these cool names for it that, like, really sound Islamic, if I'm being honest. Like, a lot of them do.
Yeah, yeah.
But
like,
yeah.
Lisan al-Ghayib, I think, is one of them. Yeah. I'm sure I said it wrong, but it was like something like
they're
that.
They're really cool names. Like, again, they sound very Arabic, very Islamic. And yeah, so they all basically just mean, like, the one. And yeah, that is, at this point, we're led to believe that it is Paul because he's having these crazy dreams. I did say earlier that he finds out when they go on their very first expedition and they find that tanker thing that's about to be swallowed by a worm. Paul runs it. This is his first, like, real run-in with spice. And he finds that he's, quote-unquote, spice sensitive, which means that, like, some people, like, it naturally makes everyone hallucinate a bit. But to him, it kind of, like, it really puts him down. Like, he's kneeling on the sand when the worm is about to come and kill, like, everything in the surrounding area. And he's not even remotely moving or anything like that. And his dad's like, what the fuck? Like, yo, get up. Like, you need to get back on the helicopter thing before we all die. And he's having these visions. He's also speaking out loud to no one in particular. So it's really cool.
I can't wait to see shit like that. I can't wait to see what it meant when he said, I know your footsteps, old man.
Yes.
There's a part where he says, like, I know your footsteps, old man. I'm like, what does that mean? That's like some Kingdom Hearts shit.
Oh, you know what? That, now that you said that, remember we talked about Gurney maybe being alive? There was a part where him and Gurney.
In the beginning of the movie,
they have a training
in the beginning
session.
Of the movie.
Gurney walks in, and Gurney walks in, and Paul's back is turned to him. And he says, I told you about having your back to the door. And it was like, I would always know your footsteps.
Yeah, he
and
says,
I recognize your footsteps. And he said, yes, but somebody could be, that he uses a specific word for it, but he essentially means somebody could be pretending to use my footsteps
to get
up close to you.
And then he still says, like, I know the difference. What's really cool about this is that, that happened at the beginning of the movie. Then there's a part where he's hallucinating and he says, I know your footsteps, old man. And then the person that saves him is Gurney, but he's not saying it to Gurney right now
because
he's in a hallucination. But Gurney's the one that actually runs up and saves him.
Yeah,
I think it is. That's actually really cool.
Yeah, I only just caught that like literally just now at this very moment. Do I understand what that most likely means? So, but again, even with his dreams and his hallucinations and stuff, we know that they don't always come true. And sometimes they're just wrong because he also has this dream of the guy he ends up killing at the end of the movie. He had dreams of that guy training him and stuff.
So this is probably my favorite part of the entire movie. This, I guess, entire sequence where he goes and he has these visions of Jamis is his name.
Yeah.
And in these visions, Jamis and Paul are friends. And Jamis is the one that trains him. He teaches him about the desert. He teaches him how to do the sand walk. And he teaches them like a lot about the culture, and he and Jamis become friends in this future timeline, right? And then when you get to the end of the movie and, you know, whatever events transpire, Jamis ends up being the person that he has to fight. And so they fight. I'm assuming you've all seen Dune. They fight. Before they fight, Paul has like a fucking vision quest where he sees the fight and he sees himself losing the fight. And
Chani tells him that, you know, Jamis is a really good fighter. He won't let you suffer. I'm gonna give you this Chris knife because you're gonna die. Like you are going to die, Jamis. There's no world where you beat him. Cause looking at Paul and looking at Jamis, if you just like thought of them person to person, there's no way you'd ever think that this little white boy is about to beat Jamis. There's just no way. But like, she's all basically saying her goodbyes. She's doing everything but saying like, bro, you're dead.
Yeah. And we also know that the Fremen are just like, they went toe-to-toe with Duncan.
Yes.
So, like, we know that in a normal fight, there's no way Paul beats Jamis, right? But Paul was, in a way, trained by Jamis in, like, the future.
Yes, it's so cool how that works.
All that stuff. And so they end up fighting. Paul wins the fight. And they have a really cool fight. Paul wins. And then what's cool is that in the vision where Paul loses, Jamis reaches down and, like, grabs his hand. And then when Paul ends up killing Jamis, Paul goes down and grabs his hand. You can almost see, like, remorse. It almost looks like Paul's about to cry.
Yeah.
And I took that to kind of mean that, like, he actually feels emotion. Like, in a way, even though it was visions, I don't really know the time lapse of it all, but it feels as though that he almost already viewed this man as a friend. And so killing him in this time.
Yeah, he doesn't want to, clearly, because he puts his knife up to his neck three times before he actually kills him. So he doesn't want to. But then the people surrounding him who are watching, they say, he doesn't know our way. We won't just like submit in a fight. We will always have to be killed.
Yeah, so it's Jamis, part of like the law.
Yeah, Jamis will not stop fighting at that point. Like you can make him submit and all of that, but it's not going to do anything. Like you have to kill him. If you don't kill him, he'll just kill you instead. So Paul realizes that, and he has to, unfortunately, kill his futuristic friend.
The other thing I like about this, now, I don't know if this is intentional, but this is one of the cool things about art where it means, what it means to you is sort of what you get out of it in a way. So Jamis in the visions, Jamis in the future, is the one that teaches Paul essentially how to be a Fremen. Jamis is, like, his teacher. It shows him all the things I already said. And so now in this version of the timeline, in this version of events, Jamis doesn't get to do that, but he's already taught Paul things, and so essentially, in this present, Paul killing Jamis in this fight is still Jamis making Paul Fremen, right? Because in the visions, it was the fact that he actually taught him how to be a Fremen, but in this, Paul becomes accepted as a Fremen because he killed Jamis in, like, this ceremonial fight.
Yeah.
And it's just, like, a really interesting thing that, basically, even though the future turned out differently, Jamis is still responsible for Paul becoming a Fremen.
Yeah.
And I find that to be super. Yeah, I find that to be super interesting.
I mean, it's the same thing with Star Wars, which again was inspired. Star Wars was inspired by Dune, and not the other way around. But Star Wars has that whole thing where they say like Anakin was supposed to balance out the Force, and he actually did though, just not the way they thought. So there were in Episode 3 when he kills all of those Jedi. there were a ton of Jedi and only like one Sith Lord at the time, which was Palpatine. Anakin becomes a Sith Lord, so now there's two, and he kills all but two Jedi.
Yep.
So he actually does balance out the Force. And so the Jedi always been talking about these prophecies, right? But like the prophecy came true. Like he did.
Yeah.
He did balance out the Force, just not the way you wanted.
Anakin's like, I am the prince that was promised.
Yeah, like I did exactly what you like. I like now, yes, there are two Jedis alive. Like there's fucking what is it? Little green one, Yoda, and I forget Obi-Wan Kenobi. So there are two Jedis. Like the Force is balanced. Execute Order 66. It's just interesting how it all happens, right? It's just really cool. At the end of the day, these prophecies tend to come true, but not the way everyone always thinks that they're going to become true. So yeah, there's other things I want to touch on in this. Like he has a spice hallucination, like I said early on, where not only does he have that whole part about, I know your footsteps, old man, but there's one where he has it near his mom and he says, you turn me into a freak. He's really angry at her.
Yeah.
Because he said, I saw people worshiping my name and there was a holy war in my name. People dying for me and stuff like that. And it sounds like this is a burden that he doesn't want to take on. Like this is not what I wanted. And you've burdened me with this life that I did not choose for myself. Like it's really, what's the word for selfish. It's very selfish to burden a child with that. It's the same thing that happened to, in Attack on Titan, Zeke. Zeke was burdened with the restorationist syndrome that his dad had, like where he like imposed that lifestyle on his son. And it made his son hate him and turn against him. Paul is feeling resentment towards the fact that his mom, like, why the fuck did you do this to me? Why did you make me into this, as he calls it, you made me into a freak? Like, he's pissed. And
in his visions of the future, like, he sees legions of Fremen holding the Atreides banner. Like, it's fucking, and it's like they're going to war in his name. There's like him and Chani, like, in a fucking, like, in an airplane.
Yeah.
And they, like, it looked like they're ready to go to war. Then there's that crazy scene where you see the Fremen come out of the sand and start killing a bunch of people.
Yep.
And there's one Fremen putting in work. And then he opens up his visor and it's fucking paws.
Like, he's Jesus so Christ. Broken. The way he was killing people was wild. He has like two blades, two Chris knives, I guess.
Yeah.
And Chris knives are made from the worm's teeth. So like they're a sacred thing because for one, we didn't talk about this a lot, but these are the things that now that we've kind of gone over what happens in a movie. So we're kind of done with that, right? Like he kills Jamis and now he's joined the Fremen. That's the end of the movie. He meets Chani. Yeah. Chani welcomes him out after this whole thing happens. She says, this is only the beginning, and it goes off. I kind of want to jump around a little bit before we completely close out the episode, but there is the whole lore about Dune that I really like. So the sandworms are considered like virtually gods on this planet. They are, in a way, they always talk about like the great worm and stuff like that.
Yeah, they keep referring to it as like the Chris knife, for example. They say like it is the tooth of Shai Halud or something. Yes, like that's it.
Yeah, Shai Halud. Refer to
the worms.
Yep. So Chris knives are made from that, so they're like this sacred weapon, and so seeing one is like a big deal because to even get that is, you can imagine, very difficult. They also say that no matter what, sandworms always come. There's a line that the doctor says early on about that, which I thought was really interesting because, like, if you're in the desert and you don't know how to do the sand walk. Like, you have to walk a specific way to imitate the natural sound of the desert. And if you walk normal, they say anything that has a rhythm to it, so how we naturally walk has a rhythm to it, right? Left, right, in a very specific way. It always alerts sandworms to come to you, no matter what. They always come. And the fact that they always come 100%, obviously that's going to be used later on, because it was even used a little bit in this movie, where when she was being killed, she started banging her hand on the ground while she was surrounded. And a fucking sandworm came and just swallowed them whole. Like, everybody who was about to kill her, and then she also gave up her own life anyway, because she's going to die regardless. So she was like, fuck it, I might as well take you guys with me. And so she banks her hand. I thought she took them with her. It was really cool, because it's kind of like a summon that everyone can do. It's like, it's not exactly the most ideal summon, but everyone could call a sandworm. They even have a device that they could put into the ground that literally just does a loud-ass thump. It just keeps thumping, and it does it in a very rhythmic way. So that it also alerts sandworms to come to it. And when they come, they just eat everything in a very inescapable large vicinity. Like,
oh dude, they are giant. When they show like his when the mouth opens up and like the carrier gets eaten by, like, it is so much fucking bigger than the carrier.
Yeah, like, it's at first I was thinking, how the fuck is this thing going to swallow something that's all metal like that and not die itself? But when you realize how small that actual carrier is compared to the size of the worm, it probably just gets digested by its stomach acid real quick. It doesn't even, it probably doesn't even make it. No, never mind. It's just like, whatever. Like, this is not, that was nothing.
Yeah, it gets
like, we can swallow pennies and nothing will happen to us. It's like, okay, yeah, like, I can swallow a penny. Like, I'll be fine.
Fucking devoured. Also jumping around, just kind of a funny thing. When, at the end, when like, when Paul kills Jamis and he gets up, when they saw Chani get up and it's like kind of in slow motion and she's like looking at him, I just like looked at it and I was like, you're Spider-Man. Like, I don't know why. Well, I mean, I know why, because it's Zendaya in fucking Spider-Man, but yeah, it was so stupid. Because
she's been playing so many different roles. She plays a crackhead, Mary Jane, and also now, basically, I guess, the love interest of the main character in Dune.
Yeah, what's interesting is that in most of the visions, although in some of the visions, Chani is the one that kills Paul.
Yes.
And I feel like in most of the visions, they are like a love interest. They're together. But as we know, the visions don't always come to pass the way he sees them. So, like, maybe they're not.
Well, he also says something interesting. He says, and this is another thing I wanted to talk about. He says that the Emperor doesn't have any sons. And I want to actually marry one of his daughters so that I could actually take the throne. And with me being emperor, I can then wave my hand and make Arrakis a paradise.
Yep.
So he has this ambition, these goals to turn Arrakis into not just a place that people come to use it and abuse it for a spice, but to actually make it what the Fremen really want for it, which is it to be like, you know, a paradise. And he says he could do that by being emperor. And they're like, what the fuck? Like, you vie for the throne? Like, you think that that's actually going to work?
He says that to Dr. Leah Kynes. And then she says, like, she's like, what don't you understand? Like, that's not going to happen. Like, you guys were fucking set up. Like,
you're talking
like he's not going to let you marry his daughter.
Yeah, like, what makes you think the Emperor, who just tried to have you and your dad killed, that he would ever let you marry his daughter? But, you know, Paul, again, these visions that he has and this ability to kind of change the future, right? Because he knows it. He can just do certain things to make it happen differently. It's pretty cool that he has this ambition. So we'll see how that plays out in the future, because again, this is going to be a trilogy. But I do like certain things like that. I like the whole thing with the sandworms, and how there's like this golden timeline that the Bene Gesserit are trying to essentially get to, and Paul's the prince that was promised, or at least it seems that way right now. A lot of times, so the same thing is true with like Star Wars and I guess Game of Thrones to some degree. Like, you always have these prince that was promised Azor Ahai at one point. Stannis Baratheon was thought to be Azor Ahai by Melisandre in Game of Thrones. And the person that you think is supposed to be this, the one, is never usually that. And because Dune is the original of all of this, like, Dune is one of the first, outside of the Bible, Dune is one of the first, like, modern takes on the one. And I'm wondering if the way how every other story I just named, where the one is never actually who you think it is, I wonder if it's going to be the same exact thing for Dune, where it's actually not him and it's someone else, which will be interesting.
It's tough to say,
because his mom is pregnant with a child.
Yeah, it is tough to say. It is interesting, right? Because he could just be like, in a way, like how you know, Lord of the Rings, and Lord of the Rings being super old and one of the originals, like, you know, Frodo is, he's not the one in that he's like super broken. But he's the one in that, like, he was the only one that could carry the ring. And it's like, well, that's just kind of what it was.
Right.
But yeah, I don't know. It's interesting. So far, like, this first movie, I'm happy to, I wasn't sure if it was going to be, you know, it's called Dune Part 1. So I knew there's going to be a part 2. Right. But I wasn't sure if there was, you know, going to be a part 3 or whatever. It is good to hear that there's going to be 3 parts.
Yes.
I think this first movie was really good. I'm very interested to see the second one. Honestly, my only real complaint, and it's just, you know, I wish it was longer.
That's a good complaint to have.
Yeah.
It is so rare that people will say a 2.5 hour movie. The movie is 2 hours, 36 minutes. It is so rare that people these days, especially, say that they wish that a movie was longer.
Yeah. Like, but that's the thing. Cause I was saying, I think the movie's paced well in that it's easy to watch. Like, when I watched it, I didn't have a hard time watching it. I think the events moved along very well. So
yes.
Agreed. It being 2.5 hours, I don't feel as though it dragged, etc. Now, maybe it was 4 hours, maybe there are parts that would drag, but I think that the movie is so, like, there's so much room for even more stuff to be in the movie that can be elaborated on, that it's just like, man, I wish it was even longer.
Where it ends seems like it just began, which is funny that Chani says that at the end, like, is this is just the beginning? You really do feel that way, though.
Yeah, when I got to the end of the movie, I even, like, kind of said to myself, like,
no, that's it.
You know, like, this is the start of season two. Like, you know what I mean? Like, yeah. This is, like, you get to the end, but it's like,
The first one is so basically built on world building and just establishing the politics, which I think is extremely important. Like, lay the groundwork. That's always important. It just sucks that it does take a really long time to do, but I appreciate it in a sense that it does do a very good job of world building and universe building. I kind of like that. It leaves a lot for the viewer to just discern on their own. It doesn't have to. Like, sometimes movies just go out of their way to say things so explicitly that it kind of takes you out of it. It's like, okay, I got it.
Yeah.
Like, this movie has a lot of implications. Like, it implies a lot. And you can kind of just pick up on it.
I appreciate that a lot. Like, for example, if I want the movie to be longer, but I don't want it to be longer because they just exposit more. That's not what I just want. Yeah. You know, like, more, like, for example, I would love for there to be some more scenes with Dr. Yue. I would love for his betrayal to, like, hurt me as a viewer.
Yes, because you feel like him and Paul maybe were close, right? Like,
Like,
him and Paul have a cute little relationship where he comes to him and talks to him about teenage stuff and things like that. And then he betrays him, and it's a really big deal. He talks about his wife and how to hearken. Maybe he says to Paul, you know, the Harkonnens have my wife and stuff, like, you know, just like lay some groundwork. And then maybe, like you said, the concubine thing with Jess and the father Leto, like, you want to see those two and how they actually love each other. And he's not just using her to be someone to give him a child, as they kind of put it. So stuff like that would actually do the movie justice. But yeah, I maybe there's a director's cut of this.
I would love that if there was a four-hour director's cut.
If they release a four-hour director's cut of Dune, I'm 100% watching it. Because, like you said, it's very easy to watch. And I feel like this movie seems like one of the ones that would have had a lot of cut-out stuff already. Like, this seems like the type of movie that would have a lot. Like, they had to cut. It's 2 hours and 36 minutes. You have to imagine it was hard to get down to that.
Yeah, there's... I do want to see, like... does HBO have, like, deleted scenes and stuff? I might check.
You can, like, I'm not sure, but it is on HBO still. That's how I watched it again.
I remember I used to love that in DVDs, right? Checking out deleted scenes.
Me too. And stuff. I actually used to love deleted scenes, especially in comedies. But yes, deleted scenes are fire. This seems like the exact type of thing that, like, a year from now, maybe, or maybe even this year, because it came out last year, maybe even this year, we'll get a director's cut of Dune. I just feel like, because of how big this franchise is, because this is a pretty big franchise, might I add. Like, this is outside of Fantastic Beasts. I don't think there's anything fantasy as big as this running right now. Like, that has an ongoing story.
Well, even the book, I can look it up or you can look it up. I think the book is one of the best-selling, like, science fiction books, or one of the best-selling books of, like, all time.
Okay, like, I'm not surprised.
The book, I feel like it sold millions, like, millions and millions of copies. Like, I'm pretty sure it is absurdly successful. There's actually even, now obviously this is in response to the movie, but I think, I don't know if it's out yet, it might be already out or coming out soon, there's a Dune video game. It's a real-time strategy game, like StarCraft. There's a Dune game, it's called Dune the Spice Wars, that's either out already or coming out very soon.
Yo, you reminded me of the era where every movie got a video game, even some that should not. Like, there was a shitty PlayStation game or a shitty Xbox game of every single movie that ever came out. I remember all those days.
Shitty Harry Potter games.
Oh my god, dog, they're so bad. There'd be like a movie of Independence Day. Like, Independence Day has a game. There'd be a fucking game of that. Like, there's so many bad ones.
And, like, Will Smith would be a character in the game. It would look like Will Smith, but it would be voiced by, like,
some random ass guy.
Just some random
guy. Absolute random. Same thing with, pretty much every movie you could think of has a really bad PlayStation game or Xbox game back in the day. And it's just funny when I thought about that. When you said that Dune has a video game, I just imagine you playing as, like, you're playing as Paul, but it's just so corny. Like, the graphics are bad. I remember those games would always be so much worse looking than the actual system could put out.
Yeah, they were so bad.
Like, the system would look one way, but the games would just be like, yo, how the fuck?
How'd you get here? The cool thing about this game, though, is that it's a RTS real-time strategy, which I think actually fits the idea of Dune a lot. Like, instead of you just playing through the story of the movie, it's just like you choose like the Harkonnens or whatever, and you, like, build up a little, it's like a StarCraft or Age of Empires.
Yeah, I mean, I don't doubt that these days, like, games based on movies have gotten a lot better. It's just, I just had to, oh, shit. Well, maybe not. I don't play video games the way I used to anymore. I pretty much play the exact ones that I want to play, and that is it. So, like,
yeah.
For me,
I'm not giving them any extra credit. I think this game could be good. I haven't played it myself yet, obviously, yeah, but the idea of it being RTS, I think, makes sense for what I've seen from Dune. But, you know. They're still shitty video game movies and shitty movies based on video games.
All right. So before we get out of here, I want to give a shout out to our patrons over at Patreon. As always, you guys support the podcast, which we really appreciate. And this is the start of a new month, May. Also, our extra episode for the month of April will be going up. So Kenny's going to do that, I can think, tonight, right?
Yeah. I've been kind of away and super busy the last couple of days, but all day I've been uploading stuff to the YouTube.
Yep. So the extra episode publicly. Will be out
it's for April. Only for the Patreon. But
Yes. So the extra episode for April, that is Patreon exclusive, will be coming out. But anyways, we have 35 patrons over here. And if you're listening to this and you're still not in the Discord server, all of our patrons have access to the Discord server. So message me and let me know, and I'll send you an invite. But we have Connie, Austin, Leon, Quest, Garen, Xavier, Hylian, TCG Automotive, Silver Chronic, Tyree Tinsley, Dimitri Barnes, Alexander Brissett, Penny Casello, Giovanni Avelos, Game Freak Yoshi, Alex Flamer, Gabe Marini, Henri Reynolds, CJ, WK Dan One, Saul at Dabber's Gaming Cafe, Dan Varable, Dennis Milburn, Joseph Marcello, Scott Page, Red Vines, First to Home, Dalis Fernares, Tom Watabiki, Estad Akuma, Mitchell Nels, Midwest Gaming, William Shapiro, Dimitri Safirdis, and last but not least, our newest patron, Chips. Thank you guys for joining. We really appreciate it. And we expect to give a lot more content. I guess I can give like a little roadmap of what we plan to do in the month of May. So one of the things I really want to do is I want to get an episode out on the Final Fantasy VII Remake, because that was my favorite game through the pandemic. I think God of War is like a close second, but for me, because of the nostalgia of Final Fantasy VII, playing Final Fantasy VII Remake in 2020, that game is phenomenal to me. So we're going to have a couple guests on for that. We're going to have our first episode, or we're planning to have our first episode that has four people in it. Bring in two guests for that one and just talk about Final Fantasy VII Remake and Final Fantasy VII in general. And probably just, I mean, you probably can't talk about those without talking about all of Final Fantasy, right? So we'll do that. Also in the month of May, we're going to do another food episode. So our food talk series that we had with Dominique Roberts. So we're going to do another one. I'm thinking maybe we could do fast food chains and just kind of like tier list them out, talk about them, because we're getting a Raising Cane's in Philly, which is a lot of duelists love this restaurant. This fast food restaurant is like a chicken spot. I love it too, but people talk about it like it is the best thing in the world. So I haven't had it in years, and we're getting one on May 12th in University City in Philadelphia. So I will be going there to try out one of those chicken tender meals, because that shit is kind of crack. So we'll be talking about, like, you know, all different fast foods and ranking them and that type of thing. We're going to have more Yu-Gi-Oh stuff, of course, always. There's also an RBET3 happening in the month of May, so we'll be doing that as well. And the people who are in our Discord...
And episode 69 will be on porn.
Yeah, we'll have episode 69, which is actually the next episode. And we will be talking So episode, this is 68. So 69 will be next. And the whole episode, we'll be talking about like hentai and like, you know, porn stuff like that. Maybe go over Pornhub's top searches.
I was joking.
I was not. I am not. So the next episode, I thought about this. I was thinking, you know, some episodes we have that don't necessarily have one specific topic. They're just kind of us just free talking, kind of what Kenny and I would do normally. And there's the reason why this podcast even exists. So I was thinking our next episode, like, that could actually be part of the discussion, not the entire discussion, but part of it will actually be on. And I have funny stories. I have funny stories about this whole thing. So it's not just going to be like some creep weird shit. I promise you guys will enjoy it. It will be very entertaining to hear. You guys like my story about when I fucking ate a condom on Halloween. So, and if you haven't heard that story, then check out my, the food talk episode where I go over my story of how I ended up chewing on a condom. As I always say, do the things that make you happy, and we are out of here.
Even if that thing is chewing on a condom.
Peace out.